Although the lead-up to the war was fought in America's public square, once the war started, many Americans seemed to lose interest in how the war was being fought on the ground in Iraq. Joining us now is George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. He was in Iraq during the early years of the war, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show now. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. In a piece that you wrote about the anniversary earlier this week for The New Yorker's blog, you described the war this way. It was conceived in deceit, born in hubris, a historic folly that took the American eye off al-Qaeda and the Taliban while shattering Iraq into a million bloody pieces. That's a pretty searing indictment. Do you think that the people responsible for the war have been held to account?
I think history is holding them to account. I think the way journalists, writers, historians, people who've looked at it critically but objectively, have the conclusions they've come to are that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and people under them, and also people in uniform, Tommy Franks, John Abizade, who's not talked about very much, Ricardo Sanchez, and others have all been found to be guilty of gross negligence, if not outright deception, and of leading the country on false pretext into a war that they had not thought through. I was thinking, as I was listening to you, your last guest, why did we go to war? And I think they decided to go to war before they knew why they wanted to go to war. And that means that it's going to be a war that is in a sense, damned from the beginning.
Although on a PBS documentary, Dick Cheney says he'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Well, that heartbeat is not all that strong in Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney is the sort of politician who will never look back at himself critically. You know, there was a whole generation of Vietnam-era officials, most famously Robert McNamara, who spent the rest of their lives, to one degree or another, asking themselves if they did the right thing. I don't think that the hawks of the Bush administration who led us into Iraq are going to suffer in that way, or if so, it's going to be very quiet. Maybe in a decade we'll get a book from Paul Wolfowitz. He's the only one I could imagine writing that kind of book like McNamara. But Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld are sleeping easily and will never ask themselves the hard questions that history has already asked and has answered.
When you arrived in Iraq in the summer of 2003, what was the mood of the country like?
It was volatile. There was a sense of both an opportunity that had been created by the war, by the overthrow of the regime, and also tremendous chaos and a sense that no one was in charge. I just remember there were no working traffic lights and no traffic police, so the streets of Baghdad were a kind of Mad Max free-for-all. Electricity was scarce. Water was scarce. There were no police. There was no one enforcing the law. And so armed gangs were already beginning to take over certain neighborhoods and kidnap and extort. You were beginning to get the beginnings of the Sunni insurgency with the first, you know, suicide bombings and car bombings and attacks on American patrols. It was an absolute vacuum.
So the optimism, the early optimism, had died very quickly?
Not died. That would be too strong. But the looting that followed the overthrow of the regime was so devastating and was so extensive. I mean, it was about $12 billion worth of looting. Imagine that. That Iraqis who had welcomed the overthrow of the regime and who had sort of cautious optimism about what the Americans were there for already were beginning to think that this is not in their own interest. This is the Americans doing something in the Americans' interest that the Iraqis couldn't understand but were beginning to feel was not in theirs. And yet, at the same time, they had lived for so many decades under such a terrible regime that they were not. Many people I talked to were not already saying this is doomed and we'll have nothing to do with it. They were stepping forward a little bit gingerly to offer themselves as, you know, to run for local councils and to join NGOs and to go to work for newspapers and radio stations. There were opportunities, and Iraqis, especially young Iraqis, especially English-speaking young Iraqis, were taking those opportunities, but they were doing it with a sense of what exactly is going on here. How could the Americans have come here with no plan and created this chaos when they're the world superpower?
I'm talking with George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the years that you were there, did anybody talk about the decision to invade? Or was it all just beside the point because everyone was trying to deal with the situation on the ground?
I felt a kind of schizophrenia in my travels between New York and Baghdad. In Baghdad, everything was about the present. It was about how to survive today, what might happen tomorrow. No one could imagine 6 months out. And almost no one was talking about the past, that is to say, the fact that America had invaded. It was a fact. It was on the ground. It was everywhere. American patrols were everywhere. The consequences of the invasion was everywhere. And Iraqis, you know, the brutality of their lives makes them extremely pragmatic about survival. And they were surviving. And surviving meant they weren't having a lot of abstract conversations about geopolitics and about what might have motivated the Bush regime and about where the WMDs were. The WMDs were one of the least talked about things inside Iraq. But then I would go home to New York, and all anyone wanted to talk about, it seemed, was why we had gone to war, the fact that it had been under these false pretexts, and the lack of WMDs. And the deeper we got into the war, the more everything before March 19th, 2003 seemed to become the center of conversation, whereas I would then return to Iraq, and once again we were in the present, and there was a terrible war going on, and everyone was wondering how it would end and whether anything would get better anytime soon.
You'd supported the invasion early on, although you've said just barely. What about the argument to invade that persuaded you, even if it was just barely?
I felt we were already, in a sense, involved with Iraq. We had been since 91. We had sanctions on that country. We had no-fly zones. There was a kind of low-grade state of war already. And meanwhile, Iraqis were suffering a kind of fate that it's very hard for Americans to imagine, living under really one of the world's worst totalitarian regimes, one that was a kind of minor league version of Stalinist Russia.
But it was only one of three members of the so-called Axis of War that
Axis of Evil
that David Frum talked about. We didn't invade North Korea, which is a worse totalitarian state. And the reason is obvious. We knew we could probably win in Iraq, and we knew we would have a major struggle if we went to North Korea.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to have to choose between Iraq and North Korea. I wouldn't care to be a citizen of either country under Saddam or the Kim family. I'm not sure it's all that seemly to be weighing these barbaric regimes against each other. But it's true that North Korea already had the bomb, and it may be that Iran, having seen the calculations that America makes in regard to that, is developing one precisely in order to prevent the overthrow of that regime. To me, there were no good answers. There were no easy answers. There were heavy, strong arguments on both sides. I came out pretty fractionally in favor. So did plenty of people who have since regretted it and who have since wondered, you know, if we'd known everything or if we'd known exactly how destructive the Bush administration's policies and practices would be, would it be done all over again? I'd say no. I'd say 10 years on, it's as I wrote in The New Yorker this week, it's one of the great disasters of American foreign policy.
Well, how quickly did you change your mind? Was it because you saw what was going on the ground?
You know, for a couple of years, Leonard, I was so focused on reporting the story and talking to Iraqis, talking to American soldiers and civilians, going back there over and over to see what was happening and how people were responding. I was most interested in the psychology of both Iraqis and Americans in this extraordinary circumstance. I wasn't asking myself that big question. And I think if you were to fault my book, The Assassin's Gate, for one thing, it's that it never asked the question, should we have done this? and came to a definitive conclusion. I think it was because I was too close to it. I wasn't ready to ask that question when I wrote that book.
And many people are concerned about embedding reporters because that makes them too close.
You know, I think that's exaggerated. Embedding is useful for reporters when they can't get to the fight any other way. And believe me, in Iraq, there were many fights you wouldn't have wanted to be in the middle of. You needed to sort of be literally physically standing on one side or the other. Over time, embedding became the only way for Western reporters to travel around Iraq because the country became too dangerous for Westerners because of the insurgency and al-Qaeda in Iraq. And at that point, there was a kind of unhealthy dependency on the U.S. military simply in order to do our jobs. And, you know, the more sophisticated and aware reporters knew that was a limit to what they could see and do. And the military took advantage by beginning to censor especially photographers in a very heavy-handed way. But I don't think it meant that reporters didn't really have an independent view of Iraq. And in the early years, in the first months and maybe the first year of the war, we were completely free. I mean, there was an ability to drive anywhere you want as long as you were willing to take the risk and talk to Iraqis and Americans and then leave. And that's what I did for the first few times I went there.
Do you think there was a moment when the White House realized that it couldn't win this war? And did they realize it before the public or after the public?
I think at the very top levels, they think they won it. I don't think they ever came to that conclusion. I haven't seen or heard one word out of the top officials to suggest that this is something they regret.
Well, George Bush wrote that he felt heartsick when he realized there were no weapons of mass destruction.
And that was a bad moment. But then the war became about giving freedom to the Iraqi people. And I think that has become the argument that allows George Bush to think that he did the right thing by history. I think there are people lower down at mid-levels who've had dramatic changes of heart. It probably didn't happen in one given night or day. I think it was a lot of nights, a lot of bad nights, and a lot of bad days. And over time, they began to realize this is something that should never have been attempted because it has become such a catastrophe.
In an op-ed in today's New York Times, Iraqi writer Ahmad Sadawi writes about how the United States lost legitimacy in the eyes of many Iraqis for failing to meaningfully support secularists and turning a blind eye to the corruption of Iraqi officials. Were American officials uninterested in Iraqi public opinion, or did they just not understand it?
I think Paul Bremer made a tragic decision to play Iraqi ethnic and sectarian politics. From the very beginning, the Governing Council, the first, you know, quasi-independent, although really under American control, governing body in Iraq after the invasion, was made up along sectarian and ethnic lines with a given number of seats to each group, Sunni, Shiite, and Kurd, and Christian. And that set the pace. Bremer and the Americans decided that we would deal with these exile politicians who represented ethnic and sectarian parties because they seemed to be the people with power, with militias, with guns. And the people who lived inside Iraq who had less sectarian ideas because they'd lived alongside each other all their lives, they were ignored. And they were considered, in a sense, sort of passive things to be acted upon by both the exile politicians and the Americans. And so I think that the author of that op-ed has a tragic and good point to make.
He also said that Iraqis blame the Americans, but they're not in agreement as to how they want to blame the Americans.
Well, you know, Leonard, it's interesting. There was a lot of polling and interviewing done in Iraq toward the end of the American experience there. And what it showed was that, for the most part, Iraqis blamed America not for being there in the first place, but for being there so destructively for so many years and for not making their lives better. Again, it's a pragmatic approach. They knew that they could not overthrow Saddam Hussein from inside. They were very unwillingly accepting of the fact that someone had done it from outside. But the fact that 10 years later, their lives are in many ways worse than under Saddam. A common thing one began to hear over the years was they were sort of regretting that Saddam was gone because it had gotten worse. That's what Iraqis can't forgive America for. And that's why, you know, on this 10th anniversary, the discussion here, once again, is all about the original decision to go to war. And that's partly what it should be about. But Americans, in a sort of very detached and abstract way, don't seem very interested in the experience of the Iraqis over the past 10 years. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to. What happened once we got there, which for many Americans no longer mattered. Only what led us there is what mattered. And that, I think, is a wrong view of the whole experience.
And our sway today is almost non-existent. Is there a way for the United States to gain any pull in Iraq, or did that ship sail long ago?
I think it's gone. I think Iran has more influence than we do by a lot. I think the Iraqi role in the Syrian civil war, acting as a conduit for Iranian weapons to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, tells you that our influence, despite our hundreds and hundreds of diplomats and CIA agents and our gigantic embassy, is minimal. The Iranians have an outsized influence. I think it will, in the end, have a backlash because Iraqis and Iranians have a deep mutual enmity from their bad history, especially the Iran-Iraq war. But right now, Iran is calling more of the shots in Iraq, and Iraq, with a Shiite-dominated government, sees itself as part of an embattled Shiite Middle East that is more and more in confrontation with a Sunni Middle East. The strategic picture has become of a regional conflict that Syria could trigger, and in that case, Iraq will be on the Shiite side, which means the Iranian side, and that makes the last 10 years seem like just a prelude by comparison.
And the Hezbollah side as well.
Exactly.
George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, covered his experiences in Iraq. I thank you so much for being with us again.
It was my pleasure.